American Ways, An Introduction to American Culture, 4th edition. Chapter 12, American Values at the Crossroads. The soul's certainty is that tomorrow will surprise us all. Alan Toffler, 1928. Is there a change in the balance between the values representing benefits or rights and the values representing the prices to be paid or responsibilities for these rights? The role of values in the national identity. John J. Zogby, an American pollster, says that Americans really know very little about themselves. Oddly enough, for a nation that conducts, reads, argues over, and bashes polls, we still have difficulty understanding who we really are. He notes that the same question is asked by every generation. What really makes us American? What is it that we all share? The nation has survived the American Revolution, the Civil War, the Great Depression, the Civil Rights Struggle, assassinations, and several attempts to impeach presidents. The reason for this survival is simple. We all share a common set of values that make us Americans. Zogby agrees with Ben Wattenberg, an expert on American culture, who believes that values matter most. These values give Americans a unique identity, and whichever political candidate or party can best represent these values wins an election. The values are the basic rights first stated in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The rights were then described in the Constitution and in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, written to protect the freedom and the rights of the American people. Zogby believes that unlike any other nation or people, we are defined by the rights we have, not by geography, by the arts and letters, not by our cuisine or sensibilities, not religion or civilization, not by war. Throughout our history, we have disagreed about the meaning of these rights and how far they should be extended, but at the same time, we have all internalized these rights as our own. The six traditional basic values we have discussed in this book, individual freedom, self-reliance, equality of opportunity, competition, material wealth, and hard work, are still a major force in American society. In this chapter, we will review the six traditional basic values and what challenges they now face. Individual freedom and self-reliance. As has been noted earlier in this book, freedom, sometimes referred to as the rights of the individual, is the most precious and the most popular of the six basic traditional values of the United States. The traditional ideas of freedom held by the Founding Fathers and written into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were dominant until the 1930s. These freedoms included guarantees of the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. There were also freedoms guaranteeing a fair criminal trial, that is, the right to a speedy and public trial, the right to a trial by jury, and the right to a defense attorney. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the New Deal greatly increased the size and responsibilities of the government. Since the 1960s and the Great Society programs, the government has continued to undertake new responsibilities. This has led to a new category of freedoms or rights that are economic in nature. For example, the Supreme Court ruled in 1963 that if a person on trial for a crime could not afford a defense attorney, the government must provide one for him or her. Almost all Americans believe that their country should strive for a prosperity shared by all. However, the idea of economic rights has a broader meaning. It means that government should, in one way or another, provide economic benefits for U.S. citizens. It is on this point that Americans differ. Indeed, this difference has been called the values divide. On the one hand, conservative, mostly Republican Americans believe that the government has gone too far in creating and guaranteeing these economic benefits. They argue that the more the government makes itself responsible for providing economic benefits, the more it makes the American people dependent on the government for their standard of living. This, in turn, takes away the self-reliance of the people, a basic national value that has helped to make the country great. On the other hand, liberal or progressive, mostly Democratic Americans, believe that the guarantee of economic rights by the government broadens and improves the traditional idea of freedom. The process of expanding economic rights should, they believe, continue in the 21st century. The possible economic rights that are being proposed include the right to medical treatment and basic health insurance, the right to a college education, the right to have a job that provides a standard of living above the poverty level, and when people are unemployed, the right to receive government assistance, especially for women and children. The debate about the proper balance between self-reliance on the one hand and government-provided economic security on the other will surely continue to be an important debate in the coming years. Equality of opportunity and competition. As mentioned before, the American ideal of equality of opportunity can be simply stated: all Americans should have an equal opportunity to succeed in life, to gain prosperity, and to pursue happiness. The United States has sometimes failed to honor this value of equality of opportunity, particularly in the case of African Americans who were subjected to slavery and then to segregation and discrimination. But the nation eventually freed the slaves in the 1860s and then addressed segregation and discrimination with the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s. Affirmative action programs were an important effort to deal with discrimination. Employers had to seek African American workers, and colleges had to recruit African American students, as well as other minorities. The philosophy of the affirmative action programs was that because of years of discrimination, many blacks did not have the skills they needed to successfully compete with members of the white majority. In some cases, at first, standards of admission were adjusted in order to allow black students to enter school. Traditionally, equality of opportunity has not meant equality of results or attainment. If a number of people have the same opportunities to succeed, some may succeed more than others. It is not up to society or the government to make sure that every person ends up with the same amount of wealth or prestige. This traditional interpretation was challenged by affirmative action programs giving racial and ethnic preferences to blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities. Those who support affirmative action argue that it has helped make up for past discrimination against minorities and that it increases the racial and ethnic diversity on college campuses. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the first Hispanic justice, is an example of someone who was helped by affirmative action. An excellent student from a poor background, she was offered scholarships from many top universities. She has written about the benefits she received from affirmative action in My Beloved World. On the other hand, there are those who argue against the policies of affirmative action. Those who oppose what they see as preferential treatment believe that everyone should have the same educational opportunities and that no one should get any special advantages. They defend the traditional idea of equality of opportunity and say that they believe in the natural diversity of the United States, not diversity mandated by the government. There have also been claims of reverse discrimination, where qualified white students were denied admission to make room for a minority student. The ultimate expression of equality of opportunity is the election of Barack Obama, the first African American president. The columnist Ezra Klein writes, "The United States of America, a land where slaves were kept 150 years ago and bathrooms were segregated as recently as 50 years ago, elected and re-elected its first black president. It is remarkable to see a black president in the White House, a man whose mother was white and whose father was from Kenya, a president who is married to a woman who is herself descended from slaves. But Barack and Michelle Obama are very mindful of what they represent, the evidence that a qualified individual from any minority background can potentially rise to the highest office in the land." In a very moving photograph, the president is leaning over to let a little black boy touch his hair to see if Obama's hair feels like his. The message of this popular photo is that black children can now say, "Maybe one day I'll grow up to be president too." The nation often struggles for a balance between the values of equality of opportunity and competition. The value of competition is most clearly represented by the institution of American business. In Chapter 6, we explored the ways that business has traditionally exemplified the ideal of competition and some of the problems that business has encountered. One of the biggest challenges facing the United States today is deciding what the role of government versus the role of the free enterprise system should be. How far should the government go to ensure the right of equality of opportunity for all? And should it be the right of opportunity or the right of attainment? In his book, Hard America, Soft America, Competition versus Coddling and the Battle for the Nation's Future, Michael Barone, a conservative, has written about this need for balance. He thinks there should be a space in the middle, with a government that saves people from undeserved social disaster while preserving the will to achieve. This middle ground is between the conservative hard culture and the liberal soft culture. Noemi Emery, a conservative columnist, describes Barone's explanation of the division in the United States this way. Hard America values risk, innovation, effort, and enterprise. Soft America values security and equality. Hard America is ruled by the market, while soft America is directed by government planning. Hard America creates wealth. Soft America reassigns it. Hard America causes undeserved suffering by making no distinction between poverty caused by sickness and poverty caused by laziness. Soft America causes its own suffering by making no distinctions between poverty caused by bad luck and poverty caused by bad habits. But the problem is really striking a balance that gets people to strive without making them desperate, that gives them support without sapping their will. President Obama, a liberal, would probably agree that the will to compete is healthy and important. In his second inaugural address, Obama said that throughout our more than 200-year history, we have always been suspicious of a strong federal government, and we have understood that not all of society's problems can be solved through government alone. Free enterprise has always played an important role. our celebration of initiative and enterprise, our insistence on hard work and personal responsibility, or constants in our character. Indeed, liberals and conservatives would probably agree that all of the six values explained in this book are important. However, liberals would probably argue that there are some Americans who are so poor and disadvantaged that they cannot be expected to be completely self-reliant or competitive. They need special help from the government and others to bring them up to the starting line of the race for success so that they can compete on a more equal basis for the benefits of equality of opportunity and the American dream. Material wealth and hard work. Material wealth has traditionally been seen as the reward for hard work. Although most people still believe in the ideal of the American dream, many are now having a difficult time attaining or maintaining it. Middle-class families are under great financial stress. Mortimer Zuckerman wrote in the U.S. News & World Report, "Millions of middle-class Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck, struggling to pay their bills, having to borrow money and go into debt. Many families are just one layoff or one medical emergency away from going into bankruptcy. Many young people believe that they will not have as good a financial future lifestyle as their parents, and one in four under age 30 feel that they are downwardly mobile rather than upwardly mobile. There are other signs that American families are falling behind. The middle class is smaller, making up only 51% of the population, down from 61% in the 1960s. Since 2000, their incomes have declined by 5%, and their net worth has shrunk by 28%. One-third of them are having trouble paying their bills. The distance between the middle class and the richest Americans is now enormous. As the recession was getting better, in 2011, the top 5% of the population, who earn more than $186,000 a year, saw their incomes rise by 5%. According to the Economic Policy Institute, households in the wealthiest 1% now have 288 times the amount of wealth as the average middle-class family. The Great Recession that began in 2008 hit middle-class families hardest, but it greatly increased the wealth of the richest 1%. Several factors have caused this stress on the middle class. First, there has been a huge decline in the number of well-paying jobs that do not require a college degree. Back in the 1970s, there were still good jobs in the manufacturing sector, with about 25% of Americans, mostly men, employed in factories. Another significant percentage were employed in other sectors that required little formal education, like construction, mining, or utilities. These were jobs that men held until retirement when they received a comfortable pension. Now these well-paying blue-collar jobs are gone. Much of American manufacturing went overseas in the 1990s, and although it is coming back, these new manufacturing jobs generally require education beyond the high school level. So the second factor affecting the middle class is the need for higher education. And in fact, the numbers of students graduating from high school and taking some college courses has gone up. One reason is that the recession hit young people harder than other age groups, with unemployment rates as high as 24%. Many young people chose to stay in school because there weren't jobs available. Entry-level jobs, usually taken by young people, were often filled by older, more experienced workers who had lost their own jobs. A significant problem that many Americans face is the incredibly high cost of a college education. The spread of community college programs has helped cut costs greatly. However, the United States really has a need for good vocational programs in fields such as informational technology and advanced manufacturing. Many believe that the United States could develop programs like some European countries have that would prepare students to take jobs that now go unfilled, even during the recession. This would require education and industry leaders to work together to develop the training programs and help put students on the pathway to these well-paying jobs. In most middle-class families, both the husband and wife are working. Their combined family income is much larger than that of the single-income family a generation ago, but they are still struggling. Zuckerman says, once they have paid the mortgage, payments on two cars, taxes, health insurance, and daycare, these apparently prosperous two-income families have less discretionary income today and less money to save for a rainy day than a single-income family of a generation ago. Many feel that they are falling further and further behind, no matter how hard they work. Health care and health insurance have become more and more expensive, taking a larger percentage of a worker's paycheck. Many in the middle class bought homes when the prices were going up, and they lost much of the value of their homes when the housing bubble burst. The net worth has fallen, and they are not saving enough for retirement. Only 25% of the baby boomers who are nearing retirement have enough saved to allow them to stop working. Their Social Security benefits will not be enough to support them in retirement. The plight of the middle class is one reason why some are now calling for the government to extend rights to a college education and a right to a decent paying job. It is also why there is so much concern over the mounting costs of Social Security and Medicare. The values divide. The disagreement about what rights the government should guarantee has caused the values divide, or the culture wars, that began in the early 2000s. John Kenneth White has written about the split in The Values Divide, American Politics and Culture in Transition, with an introduction by John Zogby. White discusses the fact that Republican conservatives and Democratic liberals disagree strongly about the role of government in solving the country's problems. He says that those on either side of the values divide live in two parallel universes. Each side seeks to reinforce its thinking by associating with like-minded people. In a series of articles in the Washington Post titled America in Red and Blue, A Nation Divided, David Vondrail explored the political split. This split is nurtured by the marketing efforts of the major parties, which increasingly aim pinpoint messages to certain demographic groups rather than seeking broadly appealing new themes. Why have the parties targeted certain groups for various political messages? First of all, the use of computers and demographic studies have made it possible to do so. Second, many Americans are only interested in one or two political issues. They respond well to targeted political messages about specific issues that concern them. Third, many potential voters are not registered members of either party, and both parties must try to persuade them to vote for their party's candidate. Neither party can win without securing some of the independent votes. Increasingly, however, most independents tend to lean toward one party or the other. Indeed, the country has become more and more polarized, to the point that the government seems to have difficulty functioning. Democrats and Republicans seem to make decisions more on the basis of ideology and less on the best interests of the nation. There is too often gridlock and too seldom compromise, many would say. It is clear that the United States now faces many challenges. One of the most serious is the need to deal with the growing deficits and the growing national debt. Democrats believe it is an income problem. The government needs more money to run the programs that they want. Taxes should be raised and the wealthiest should pay a higher rate. Republicans believe it is a spending problem. The government should lower taxes and reduce spending by cutting programs. The private sector, business, should take over programs now run by the government. Zogby says this split reveals more than a question about the role of government. This is about how Americans define responsibility, citizenship, and values they want their government to express. CNN's chief political analyst, Gloria Borger, says that Americans have a love-hate relationship with their government. Americans want the government to fix our problems, but they don't trust the government to do it. We want health care to be fixed, Medicare and Social Security to stay intact, emergencies to be handled. We also want lower taxes along with a smaller yet more responsive government. All in all, we would like to spend less and get more. The public distrusts government because its leaders haven't been able to work together to produce much of anything. Ronald Reagan, a popular Republican president, understood the public's skepticism about government. He often joked that the scariest sentence in America is, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." This suspicion of government is not new. Tocqueville noted that Americans loved both freedom and equality. Throughout their history, Americans have lived with a tension between preserving freedom and promoting equality. Tocqueville believed that in a democracy, Americans would eventually choose equality over freedom because of the material benefits that equality could bring. However, political scientists have disagreed, recognizing that Americans strongly value freedom, possibly more than any other country. A recent Pew poll asked Americans and Europeans to choose between freedom to pursue life's goals without state interference and the state guarantees nobody is in need. In contrast to the Europeans, the majority of Americans chose freedom, the United States and the world. In spite of the current image of the United States and some of the actions the government has taken, there has been a long historical tradition of isolationism. President George Washington declared in 1796, "It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world." The spirit of isolationism persists even today, as Americans continue to debate their place in the world community. Many Americans are very reluctant to see the United States become involved in international military actions unless they are convinced that there is some national interest to be protected. Americans are also skeptical about international economic alliances and global agreements, wanting to be sure that their self-interests are protected before commitments are made to other countries. Many Americans are more interested in what is happening close to home than what is happening in the rest of the world. They want to know how events, national or international, will affect them personally. Today, it would be impossible for the United States to isolate itself from the rest of the world, even if it tried. While some scholars would say that the United States and its culture played a dominant role in the 20th century, its role in the 21st is unclear. However, the rest of the world will certainly continue to have a great impact on the United States, particularly on its economy. A continuing concern for Americans will be protecting themselves from potential terrorist threats, both overseas and at home. There will be more consideration of how much power to give the government in exchange for this protection. In a free and open society, it is impossible to guarantee that terrorist attacks will never happen, and Americans must weigh how much freedom and privacy they will give up in order to be secure. Finally, there is the question of immigration. The levels of legal and illegal immigration are high, and some Americans are worried about the assimilation of all these people from different countries. What will happen to the traditional American values as the population of the United States becomes increasingly diverse? On the other hand, many recognize that all these new immigrants bring new life and energy into the United States. They often come with a stronger belief in the six basic cultural values than many Americans have. As the baby boomers get older, immigrants are an important source of youth and vitality for the nation. A number of them are coming with the technical skills and STEM degrees, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, that the United States needs in industry. Perhaps most importantly, the diversity of ideas and cultures in the United States are one of its greatest sources of strength in the 21st century. Ben Wattenberg, an expert in American culture, believes that the United States is becoming a microcosm of the world. It may be the first universal nation, where people from every race, religion, culture, and ethnic background live together in freedom under one government. The American people and their values have reached another historic crossroads. Will these traditional values endure through this century? 100 years from now, will Americans still have a sense of national identity, of being American? What new challenges will this century bring? As Alvin Toffler said, the sole certainty is that tomorrow will surprise us all.